we go. We are in Mark 4. It's a very well-known story of Jesus being asleep on the boat. We're going to take a look at a picture by Rembrandt. Rembrandt, if you know this, would have written or would have painted in the early 1600s. So 1633, he is 29 years old when he does this painting. 29 years old, and Dale, I don't know if you can make that picture any bigger, but that's as big as we can get. There are 14 people on that boat. Now, what's fascinating is, of course, how many disciples do you have?
12.
There's 12, and then there's Jesus, 13. So who's 14? Well, if you are able, and you're probably not, and I'm standing here, but right next to the guy with the cloak on is somebody in blue. You see the guy in blue? That's Rembrandt. He would paint himself into every painting that he did. And so it's fascinating. And of course, he's Dutch, which if you want to know more about being Dutch, you can talk to Karen. So here is how this works. Of course, she's Swedish. Swedish.
No, Norwegian.
Like I said, she's Norwegian. I do that on purpose. She's so easy. She's just so easy. Anyway, so this really isn't a boat from Galilee. You saw a boat that they were last week. It probably didn't have that sail, that kind of stuff. But this is a boat that they did use in the Netherlands, so that's what Rembrandt used. We're going to come back to this story, but it's a wonderful thing to start to look at. Okay, so we're on the Sea of Galilee, and Galilee in the New Testament is an area. You have the Sea of Galilee. Sea in Greek would be Thalassia, but Galilee is a district. It would be like Medina County or whatever like that is, and it means circuit or a circle. And so there is this area in and around Lake Galilee that they called Galilee. And I didn't know this until I started to track things down, but it was called Galilee of the Nations. So Josephus would actually call it of the nations because there was a hodgepodge of people that lived here. It wasn't just Jewish people. It was Roman people. It was people from Lebanon. And so this was an area that they all rallied around or lived in. So it was a mishmash of people. To think it was all Jewish is a misunderstanding completely. So Jesus was in a community from all kinds of ethnic roots. All right, so that's the first thing to get to know. Here are some other things about this. The Sea of Galilee, you would come west, so it's coming at me, you would hit a first set of hills, or they would call them mountains. They're not the Rocky Mountains. They're probably not even as high as some of the West Virginia mountains, but in Israel, they would be mountains. So on the mountains, you would grow things like olive trees. If you like olive oil, there would be fruit trees there. And then it comes down and you come into a valley, and it's in the valley where they would grow wheat and barley. Then you would hit the Sea of Galilee, and then you go up the other side, and there's more mountains. So this thing is encircled. It almost looks like a cereal bowl if you could see it from up on high. So that is what Galilee actually looks like. Here is rainfall. Being that we have some folks that like to keep track of weather, and I was asking Jim earlier, Jim, how does this poem make any sense to you? And maybe John knows this. And you all know this poem. Red sky at night. Now, why is that? Okay. And then red sky in the morning. Well, now, why is that? It's still red. Anyway, I do know that for a fact, as you have the weather, Jim, I knew part of it. As the weather goes up, you have a very stable atmosphere. There isn't a whole lot of movement up there, so all the dust has settled. But that's the red sky at night. I don't know why red sky in the morning is supposed to be like a warning if you're out there on a lake. But now let's talk about this lake, Lake Galilee. There's hills on both sides, and you've got the Mediterranean. And for those of you that don't know this, the nation state of Israel was starting to be worried that Galilee, Lake Galilee, was shrinking. They were losing water because a lot of irrigation happens there. And so Israel, 15 years ago, decided to build a tap or a pipeline into the Mediterranean and pump Mediterranean water into Lake Galilee. So now it's back up to its normal height. But they were losing water. But why storms? So what happens is, as you take a look at Israel, Lake Galilee would be in the northern part. It's very fertile, very green. They get about 25 inches of rain a year, and that's pretty close to what Ohio gets. So in some ways, their precipitation is about this, what you and I experience here. What we don't experience is the storms. In the winter, even now, they'll have storms where the winds reach 70 to 75 miles an hour. It's very, very windy. And you might say to me, Bill, go ahead and say, Bill.
Bill.
Oh, see, I love that. So here you have up at Mount Hermon, which is north and to the east. When I was there in March and all through April, people were skiing on Mount Hermon. So it's kind of crazy. You go down to the Dead Sea, it's 90 degrees. And that's only 4 hours. But you go north and you can be skiing. Isn't that crazy, the difference in weather? Anyway, so you've got this very cold air that is up there on Mount Hermon. And when the wind comes from the east, it comes over what is known as the Golan Heights. And if you are tracking, if you want to see what's actually going on in Israel, I would suggest that you pull up a thing called the Jerusalem Post. It's their national newspaper. And it will tell you that even right now, this week, there would be people from Hezbollah or Lebanon bombing the Golan Heights. That would be the western or the eastern side of northern Israel. All the wind comes from the east, comes from Mount Hermon, and it hits that mountain range, and the mountain has a bunch of ravines in it. And the cold air runs into those ravines, and then it comes out onto that lake where it meets the warm air of that sea, and it becomes turbulent. As a matter of fact, they have a word for it over there called the Ventura winds. And it's very turbulent. And it can come up on you really fast. And so as you read this scriptures, which we'll read in a second, you're going to find that Jesus has just spent his day teaching. That's what he did. He taught them the parables. Parable of the sower and the seed, the mustard seed. And by the end of it, he was tired. And he said, hey, to the people in the boats, there was more than one boat. If you don't have that in your head, it's plural. The word boats is plural there. Let's go to the other side. And so, now let's see what happens. And on that day, when evening had come, he said to them, let us go over to the other side. So they are now in the boat that I showed you last week. It is approximately 27 feet long is the boat. It's 7 feet wide. And it's 4 feet deep. It did not have a sail like the sails that you see in this. So when you put 14 people or 13 people, 12 disciples and Jesus, in the boat, it's probably sitting pretty low in the water. Here comes this storm. Verse And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was in the boat, and the other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind. What's fascinating is when I track that word down, fierce, it is Arabic for shark, sharkia. And I thought, really? They called winds sharks. Which is like, really? I'd never seen that before. And I kind of laughed too when I read it. Anyway, so, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was filling up. So here you have 27-foot-long boat. All these people were fishermen, so they were pretty aware of how to function on a boat. And the boat was filling up with water. And he himself was in the stern. Now, do we have any boat people in here? Where's the stern? Look at you. Right here. The stern is in the back. That's where the rudder is. Although they didn't have rudders there. They would have a guy who would maintain basically an oar in the water. And so he's making it work. But Jesus is in the back of the boat. And he's asleep on the cushion. Well, now that's really interesting. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Isn't that fascinating? So here are guys who have spent their lives on a boat, and a storm comes up, and they're afraid for their lives. 39, and being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." Now, the word there is terrified. They were terrified, but it goes beyond that word terrified. It actually is mega terrified. So they would use the hyper also. So they were really afraid. So Jesus says, "Hush, be still." And what's really crazy about the way it's written in Greek, it's like "hush and remain still." It's not just "be still," but "remain still." All right then. And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, and here's where we're going to spend the rest of our time this morning. "Why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith?" And they became very much afraid. There it is, mega afraid again. And they said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now at this point in their journey, they are aware that Jesus is unique. He has made claims to be God. But here he is on the boat and he's asleep. How many of you have ever felt like God's asleep and I've got a disaster going on here? And you're like, "I need help now." Is there a 911 number to call God? Yeah. You know, and here they are. "Master, don't you care that we're perishing?" How many of you have said, "Yeah, God, you know, I'm in a mess." And you feel like God's asleep. How many of you have felt like God's asleep? Yeah, me too. Is he? You know, the scripture says in the Psalms that he neither slumbers nor sleeps. He who watches over Israel will never slumber and will never sleep. And yet, there are times when God allows things to happen in our lives to force us to talk to him. It's not what we want. It's not what we like. And yet, it is what happens. The other thing I would point out to you is that in the work of Mark, Mark will have a teaching, and then Jesus gives a test. How many of you liked tests? I like giving them. I didn't like taking them. But there is a sense. Jesus taught them about the parables, and then he gave them a test. The test was about their faith. Now let's talk about faith. He says, why are you so timid? What has happened to your faith? And I would have all of you ask yourselves the same question. Where's my faith? The word faith in the scriptures is a Greek word called pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S. It's also pistuo. And faith has three working definitions coming out of Greek. It can mean belief. It can mean faith. And the faith is what you saw with these folks who were baptized today. I'm going to put my faith in Jesus Christ. But now, there's this next word where most of us live, and it means trust. T-R-U-S-T. And Jesus is going to take us into things where we have to trust him. And that's going to make most of us really nervous. I'd rather do anything other than have to face some things. And yet, God does those things. Why do you think? I hear Becky Bourne, she was talking to Jerry, but she didn't like talk loud enough for the rest of us. Sure, to test us. Here, let's take a peek. If you have sermon notes, you go down to the bottom. I've got the Geneva Bible. How many of you have ever read anything out of the Geneva Bible? I hadn't until I started wandering around. And the Geneva Bible was written in 1537. It was before the King James. It was based on Tynedale, who wrote, and then King James thought he should have a Bible named after him. Really? I've decided not to do that. You won't know of King Bill's Bible. Anyway, but listen to the way this is written. It's really interesting. It says, Christ leaveth us oft, A-O-F-T-E, oft, times to ourselves, both as will, that we may learn with an E to know our own weaknesses as his mighty power. Part of what happens in tests is you find out what you know and what you don't know. And as much as a lot of us don't want to have to go through tests, if you're learning things about yourself, you're going to find out where you need work. How many of you passed your driver's test the first time? Overachievers. How many of you had to do the second time? Okay, how many had to do the third time? I'm all by myself. But every time, you know, I was lucky enough to get the same person tested. They said, you know, you really got to study. You seem to get lost right in this stuff here. They're really helpful. But they pointed out what I needed to know. And I would say to you in your journey of faith, there is things that all of us have to learn to trust Christ about. And here comes the hard part. It's going to be around our fears. It's going to be around our fears. So I've made a list of various fears. Some of them are silly. Some of them are not so silly. Glossophobia. Fear of public speaking. How many of you have a fear of public speaking? I do not have that fear. That's news to some of you. How about agoraphobia? That is fear of open spaces. Here's one, aquaphobia. It sounds like an aftershave lotion. Aquaphobia, fear of water. Do you know anybody who has a fear of water? My mother. I've belonged to a pool all of my life. It was one of the ways my dad said, we're going to get all the kids out of the house. You're going to go to the pool. Here's your season's pass. Every day. It could be snowing, and my mother still said, you're going to the pool. So, but my mother would never get into any pool that was higher than her knee. She's like, I'm not sure, it could drown me. But yeah, she would not do, but she had this fear of water. And my dad grew up on Long Island. He was always around water. He'd call her, Kate, Kate, you can do this. And she'd say, I know I can, but I'm not. Because I'm afraid of water. Here's another one, claustrophobia, fear of cramped spaces. And then xenophobia, fear of people groups. And in this story that you just read, what the scriptures would call a pericope, it's a part of a chapter, you find that when Jesus calms the sea, hush, be still, those guys in the boat drop and say, who is this? And they are afraid. And there is a sense of xenophobia. And here's the reason. They are encountering God above. And whenever in the scriptures you have anybody that encounters Christ where he actually shows who he is, a lot of times they fall on their face. Because they don't know what to do standing in front of God himself. Now, I'm going to go down one side road just for some of you, just so you can see this. In the early church, they would deal with heresies every 100 years. And all of the creeds that we have, so the Apostles' Creed, the Didache, which is what the Apostles' Creed was based on, and then you'd have the Apostles' Creed, then you'd have the Nicene Creed, then you would have the Chalcedonian Creed. All of those creeds were written to answer certain questions. And one of the questions was, and this came about from Marconian, that how can Jesus be both God and man at the same time? That was one of the major debates. And so the Nicene Creed had to wrestle with that. And here's the big word that if you go on Jeopardy and you can answer this question, remember to send us some of the money. But it's called the hypostatic union. Sorry for the big word. But what it means is that Jesus was a perfect balance between being human and being God. So here you have Jesus who's asleep on a cushion. He's tired. As a matter of fact, it's the only of the four Gospels that tell you that Jesus is tired. So he's experiencing being human. How many of you have been tired this week? Don't go to sleep at the wheel. No, but get home, get a nap, do what you got to do. But you're human. Allow yourself to be human. But when they woke Jesus and they said, don't you care that we're perishing, his divinity comes out. He stands up, raises his hand and says, hush, be still. And so this is one of the few times in the New Testament that you see both the humanity and the divinity of Jesus in the same story. And so the early church would access this particular story to try to explain that Jesus was both fully man and fully God. It's really a wonderful story, but most people have never really wrestled with those questions. It's almost like we're in the deep end of the pool and we don't like swimming. Anyway, that's one of the things that we're wrestling with. Okay. So now let's deal with our fears. There's a lot of things that we are fearful of as people. I have made a list. Some of these, maybe you wrestle with yourself. We will have storms of sorrow. Things that, it's like the storm never stops. We go from one sad thing to another. Storms of doubt. How can God let this happen to me? You know, one of the major questions, both of the New and the Old Testament, and over the history of the church, is this one word that keeps popping up. And it's the word, why? Becky Boyd knew that. Becky, you could be a preacher. So there is this sense in which we all have questions, and they all have to do with why. God, why did this happen? Why did you allow this to occur? And it's almost like we're Job. And if you remember, Job said, you know, God, if you'll let me, we'll put you on trial and put you in the docket. That's an old English term for putting the person on trial. You're in the docket. And he says, let me put you in the docket. I'm not sure that was a good idea for Job. But that is what happened. But he had doubts. Here's another one. Tensions. Are there things in your world that you're tense about? You're wound up. It's kind of like you've loaded the spring. And you're like, man, if this thing lets go, I'm not sure what'll happen. But we're tense. Here's some other words. Uncertainty. I'll tell you this story. John Long, I've been the pastor here for at least 2 weeks. Well, I think I've been here maybe 6-7 years. And right around year 3 or 4, John came to me and said, now, Bill, if I die, will you do this? Will you do the service? And I said, sure. We'd love to be a part of that. But John, what's going to happen if I go first? Here was his line. I have to find somebody else. Isn't that great? I love that about him. Anyway, here's another storm. Anger. What do you do with your anger? It doesn't say don't be angry. It says be angry, but sin not. Has there ever been a more confusing passage? Anyway, anger, fears, anxiety for ourselves and others, our unknown future about those we love. I hear this phrase, Lord, don't you care that we are perishing? And you can almost sense their frustration and their desperation. God, we need for you to act, and you're asleep. And yet I would say to you, at least in my journey, I've been a believer since I was in high school. God doesn't come when I want him to. But he always comes in time. He always comes right when I need him.
That's because he's always there.
I like that.
Amen.
I like that. And so I would say to you, gather with people, be with people, be encouraged by people. But understand, there are some things that people can't answer for you. They can't do for you. And you only have one place to go. It's to God, who you and I think at times is asleep on the cushion. And he is okay with having you say, don't you care? And you know what I think you're going to hear? I really do care. Hear that little kid's song that you and I grew up with. Jesus loves me. For the
Bible tells
me so. That's true for you. And that's true for me. Dale, put my picture back up on the screen. Okay, so now we come back to Rembrandt. This he drew in 1633. He was 29 years old. What you may not know is that in 1990, for almost 30, 40 years, it was part of a collection in Boston that was owned by Isabel Gardner. And she had a museum in that town. And on March the 18th, right after midnight, two guys dressed as policemen broke in and they stole this picture. It has not been seen since that day. This picture is worth over $100 million. They have no idea where it is. They have had all kinds of people involved, and that's now almost 30 years. There's been all kinds of people who said, I know what happened. Melinda and I were kind of laughing about this on Thursday night. There was a gangster in, it's in Boston, is where this took place, that's where this was. And a guy by the name of Bulger said, I know who did that. And then he died. What? He died? It could be at the bottom of a hole. But nobody knows where this thing is. This passage, this piece of art, has been missing since those years. But the story and the truth of this passage is alive every time we read the scriptures and we realize that there is Jesus, there's two people, one has got the rudder, and then the very next person is Jesus. He's on the boat. And I would say to you, every storm that you have in your life, Jesus is on that boat with you. Don't make the mistake of not crying out and asking for help. It's a wonderful story. And if by chance some of you know where that painting is, we'd be really interested in knowing. But let's sing this one last song together. Okay, we're going to do this one really slow. And then we'll speed it up. Here we go. To teach it to you. Oh, the words. There they are. He's my rock, my sword, my shield. He's my wheel in the middle of the field. He's my lily of the valley. He's my bright morning star. Makes no difference what they say.
Right here.